Welcome to Trapping Across America, where fur brothers meet every week. Where we're still allowed to be men, and we're proud to be from the land of the fur and the home of the brave. This is Clint Locklear with Trapping Radio. I wish I could say that I was out pounding fur today, but Mother Nature is throwing a hizzy here in Tennessee. I've been out on the river trapping some muskrats, and we have got rain on top of rain on top of rain. So trying to deal with the high water is one thing. Now we've got about 50 mile an hour winds today, and I had the boat in the water for about 10 minutes till I realized I'd rather keep breathing instead of start swimming. So I'm back home, so it's giving me a little bit of time to do the show today without being so rushed, and I wish I was out there on the water, and hopefully tomorrow it'll clear up a little bit. They'll open some of the dams up, drop the water, and the wind will lay down on me. But whatever you're doing on your own trap line, I hope Mother Nature's not hurting you too bad. One thing about this season for most people I've talked to, if you're going to be a professional trapper nowadays, you better learn how to trap in the rain. Well, kind of what I'm going to talk about today is coyote snaring, maybe a little bobcat snaring, depends on time. Before that, we're going to have another beginner's quarter by beaver trapper from Alabama. And before we get into that, I got an email from Neil Graves, and he sent me a forward, which is basically just a page off the Sportsman's Alliance, which you can get that pretty much. Find this article because it's great information. Is ussportsman.org is the website address, and you can find this on here. But it's a very interesting article. You need to know kind of who your enemies are. And what this is, it's called the Dirty Dozen. And they are not joking. Well, I'm going to run down these just so you kind of get an idea who we're up against all the time and just how insane these nut jobs are. Number one on their list is one of mine and your favorites, the Humane Society of the United States. They need no introduction to hunters and trappers everywhere, but has been the news and advertisements recently for sharing only 1% of their funds to animal shelters. Why they raked in $187 million. So if you know someone that's donating money to one of these groups, just call them an absolute sucker to their face, because that's exactly what they are. Number two of the Dirty Dozen is PETA. They're outrageous, radical, out of touch with mainstream. They're out of touch on issues related to pets, food, hunting, trapping, fishing, and any other topics. PETA also promotes a vegan lifestyle and has many programs to turn children against farming, hunting, trapping, fishing, and other mainstream lifestyles. This group paid legal fees for a conviction of animal rights terrorist. So not only are they trying to turn your kids into not liking what you're doing, they're also paying legal fees for convicted animal rights terrorists. Who would have guessed from such a nice group of people like PETA? Center for Biological Diversity makes a living suing mainly the federal government, then recouping these fees and more. CBD strives to expand the Endangered Species Act to include hundreds of animals and plants. The group has also been involved in some seemingly tangible activities such as passing out condoms in a campaign about controlling the human population, because you know we're the real problem. Defenders of Wildlife works to save an increased number of wolves, prairie dogs, and other nuisance species roaming America. But there is no doubt Defenders' main focus is on their misguided effort to protect and restore wolves throughout the lower 48. They do this without regard to the havoc caused by uncontrolled wolf populations and other wildlife species such as moose, elk, and mule deer. According to the group's IRS 990, Defenders of Wildlife collected more than $29 million in support and spent more than $1.5 million on fundraising during that period. So basically, they're just a group that makes a living off suing. American Society of Preservation of Cruelty to Animals. This sounds like a nice one, because who wouldn't be against cruelty to animals? I know I'm not. Thinks hunting and trapping are cruel and should be outlawed everywhere, beginning with wildlife refuges. In other words, the land you pay taxes on is not for your use. It advances its anti-hunting agenda by lobbying legislators, government officials, and policymakers to obtain support for anti-sportsman legislation. The ASPCA encouraged grassroots activists to take part in letter-writing campaign to legislators and encourages boycotts of products tested on animals. Sierra Club. Sierra Club and many of its chapters oppose access to roads to the vast tracts of public land. Also opposes many scientific wildlife management practices. Sierra Club's legal defense fund has frequently sued federal government over these issues, then sought reimbursement for these legal expenses. Many of its chapters have actively opposed hunting. For an example, a New Jersey Sierra Club chapter has been a leader in opposing that state's rights of bear hunting. The Sierra Club Grand Canyon chapter worked to end all hunting in Arizona with Proposition 109. Sierra Club in California opposes bear hunting with hounds. Yes, asking speaks louder than words. The Sierra Club and many of its chapters are anti-hunting. I know a lot of people get confused by this group because they give hunters the impression they're on their side while they're sitting there trying to stab them in the back otherwise. Friends of Animals. Everybody wants to be a friend to an animal. As opposed to deer, goose, and wolf and any other type of hunting. The group has formed protests against deer management hunts in the Northeast and also protested in Montana opposing wolf hunting. Wild Earth Guardians is opposed to trapping and work to end trapping on all public lands in New Mexico, according to the group's website. They also oppose wolf and mountain lion hunting. And I've been out there and I've talked to some of those game wardens in New Mexico. And if they could figure out a way to bend the rules, they would want you out there trapping those. The lions, just like they are in Nevada and parts of California, all the way up into Oregon, are decimating the deer population. I don't know where these people come from where they think you can just let something take over like that, then you're going to have a good, sound wildlife system to depend on. Number 9 of the Dirty Dozen is Animal Wildlife Welfare Institute, sued to stop trapping in Maine because of the Canadian lynx. And we all know about this from a couple of years ago. They reported it wants to end torture inflicted on fur-bearing animals by steel jaw traps and wire snares. The group's website also reports that it wants to end cruel and irresponsible hunting and trapping, capture and killing for profit. I guess that's definitely us. The group has been active since 1951. They've produced a Trapped Animal and Call of the Wild brochures filled with sensational myth truths to represent its opposition in trapping and in the fur industry. I believe we've all seen probably some of those. Okay, number 10 is the Animal Legal Defense Fund. Opposes hunting and trapping and notes that animals are entitled to basic legal rights in our society. Well, you know, as a taxpaying citizen, I'd kind of like to want to have some legal rights myself. But if I can't get it, a squirrel shows hair isn't going to get it. They believe a squirrel should be able to sue you for hunting it. The group's IRS 2010 form reports revenue of more than $5 million. Now tell me, what kind of idiots do we have in this country that they're going to give $5 million of their dollars during downtime of our economics to be able to have a squirrel sue for being hunted? Number 11, in defense of animals. Worldwide organization founded in 1983 and would like to see all hunting banned. It's also strongly opposed as trapping and other forms of animal use is based on the opinion and facts of it, since we're unduly exploiting animals. International Fund for Wildlife Welfare, an international organization that has done considerable work to ban hunting and hounds and seal hunting. It boasts of approximately 2 million members worldwide and believes all animals and human are linked in fate. It first gained notoriety when it campaigned to ban Canadian seal hunts. The reason I kind of went over that real quick is you need to understand where these people are coming from. You know, they don't think you should be able to profit from wildlife, even though I myself is a official member of the Organic Free Range Wild Fur Farmer Association of America. They don't think we should be using our land that we pay taxes on to do it. They want to cut off access to our roads. They want to make sure that because some animals they deem more vital than others survive, so the rest of them can be wiped out. There again, later on, when that starts really happening in great numbers, they'll start having other organizations, I'm sure, that'll start trying to save the deer in these places. The mountain lions they've been protecting have already destroyed. Well, that's the Dirty Dozen, something to keep in mind. When you hear some of these, especially Sierra Club, because a lot of guys think that they're for hunting, and they're not. Let's get on with Beginner's Corner. I believe this week is on snares, and then I will get into coyote snaring.
Welcome to Beginner's Corner on Trapping Across America. I'm Beaver Trapper in Birmingham, and this segment of the show is dedicated to those fellas just starting out, or better yet, those fellas wanting to get started but don't know where to start. Hello and welcome to another edition of Beginner's Corner. Tonight we're going to talk about basic snaring. The first thing I'd like to talk about is what a snare is. Or rather, let's start with what a snare is not. If you spend any time on internet survivalist boards or outdoor boards, you've probably seen a lot of snares that are what I would call primitive snares. They rely on some sort of twitch-up pole, or they're made from primitive cordage or some type of picture wire or brass wire or trip wire. That's not the type of snaring that a professional trapper uses. The type of snaring that we're talking about are snares that are made of aircraft cable. These are professionally made snares or snares that you can make at home, but they're designed to take basically anything from a mink to a wolf and anything in between and hold it. You're not going to do that with primitive snares, with picture wire or twitch-up poles or anything like that. If you're going to get into snaring, you need to make sure that you use a quality snare. So what exactly is a snare? Basically, a snare is a piece of aircraft cable that's designed to catch an animal while he's traveling in his normal gait, as opposed to a baited set that attracts the animal and then catches the animal. Now, a snare consists of several components. First of all, you have the cable. There are different types of cable, and each type of cable has different characteristics depending upon what you like and what you're trying to accomplish. One type of cable, and the most common, is a 7x7 cable. And basically, 7x7 cable is 7 bundles of 7 strands of fiber. And it's a general purpose type of cable. It can be used on basically any animal. It's commonly used for coon, fox, beaver, coyote. The 7x7 is an all-around type of cable. It holds a fairly good loop. It's fairly durable. It's not expensive. And it's what most beginners usually start out using. Another type of cable is called 1x19 cable. And basically 1x19 is one bundle of 19 strands of wire. This type of cable is a stiffer type of cable. A 1x19 tends to hold a more round loop. It tends to fire a little bit faster, but it's also a little bit more difficult to work with. The third type of cable that's available that you don't normally use when making snares is a 7x19 cable, and that's a cable that consists of 7 bundles of 19 strands. This type of cable is very ropey, it's very flexible, but basically 7x19 is not normally used to make a snare. So we have the cable, but that's not the only part of a snare. In order to make a loop that will close and stay closed and hold the animal, we have to have what's called a lock. There are different types of locks, but basically the lock is the device that when the cable is pulled tight around the animal, it keeps the cable from opening back up. It actually holds the animal in the loop. Everybody has their own favorite type of lock, depending upon what conditions they're in, what animal they're snaring. A cam lock is a good all-around lock. Personally, I like to use a slim lock. I've used Gregerson locks in the past with good results. It comes down to a matter of personal preference, in my opinion, as to what lock is the best. So if you're just getting started out, I wouldn't get hung up on a particular type of lock. The last part of a snare is the end point of the snare, and there are two types of end points. You can have a swiveled snare that has a swivel on the end, and you can have an adjustable loop end snare. And basically the idea with the swivel is that as the animal is caught and he struggles to get away, the swivel will allow the cable to swivel around and not kink up as badly. The adjustable loop end doesn't have a swivel built into it, and the idea is that since the end of the cable has an adjustable loop, it's a little bit easier to attach it to a tree or a stake or whatever you're going to anchor your snare to. So those are the three portions of a cable snare. Basically, you have the cable, you have the lock, and then you have the end where it attaches to the anchor. The next thing that you have to consider is how you're going to support your snare. And there are a lot of different ways, a lot of different systems to support snares. Some people use a fairly thick 9-gauge wire with a whammy. And basically a whammy is a support collar that fits on the snare and it allows you to insert the number 9 wire into the support collar and then adjust the snare to the proper height and the proper location. Some people use 14-gauge wire and simply wrap it around the snare cable itself. So there are a lot of different ways that you can do that. And if you just spend some time on some of the internet boards or some of your trapping websites, you can see dozens of examples of how to support a snare and how to attach the snares. In my opinion, there's no right way or wrong way. A lot of it depends on your personal preference and your location. Now that you have your snare and your support system, probably the most confusing aspect of snaring to the beginner is the subject of loop size and loop height. You'll probably find more questions about loop size and loop height on snaring message boards than any other type of question. One of the most common mistakes that I see beginners making is to use too big of a loop. And I think this happens because when you actually get out in the field and you go to set your snare, you're in the trail or the travel way, you're a little hesitant, you lack a little bit of confidence, and you're not sure that the animal is going to stick his head through the loop. So you say to yourself, I'm going to make sure that I get him. I'm going to open this loop up just a little bit. I'm going to make it a little bit bigger just to make sure that I don't miss him. And believe it or not, that's probably the worst thing that you can do. You would be shocked at how an animal can get through the loop of a snare without getting caught when the loop is too big. As a good general rule of thumb, if you're snaring coon, you may want to go with a 5-inch loop, 5 to 6 inches off the ground. For coyote, you're going to need a bigger loop, a little bit higher off the ground. So you may want a 12 to 14 inch loop, 12 to 14 inches off the ground. By contrast, if you were snaring beaver, you may want a 10 to 12 inch loop, and if you're on dry ground, it may be an inch or two off the ground. Whereas if you're snaring beaver in the water, the bottom of the loop may be 2 to 3 inches underwater. So you just sort of have to play with it a little bit and see what happens, see if your loops get knocked down, or if you're catching the animal as you intended to catch them. But the main thing is don't overestimate how big of a loop you need. And a good thing to do is to actually practice making your loops and then measure them. When you tell somebody to make a 6-inch loop or a 12-inch loop, it's funny just to watch them do it and then actually measure the loop size and see how far off they are. A 6-inch loop is a lot smaller than what you might think. So anyway, those are the basics to snaring. Make sure that you're going to use a good professional quality aircraft cable snare. Make sure that it's got the type of lock that you want. Make sure that it's got the type of end that you want, whether it's a swivel or an adjustable loop end. Make sure that you know how you're going to support your snares, what type of wire you're going to use to support your snares. Make sure you know how you're going to anchor your snares. And then make sure that you have a good idea of what your snare should look like as far as loop size and height off the ground for the animal that you're going after. If you do those things, I think you'll find that snaring has a lot of advantages if it's legal for you. They're lighter, they're cheaper, theft is less of a problem, and I like snares a lot. Here in Alabama, we can only use them in the water, so I do a lot of beaver snaring. And I tell you, carrying a dozen snares is a lot easier than carrying a dozen 330s, that's for sure. So I hope this has been of use, and we'll see you next time on Beginner's Corner.
Last week, we kind of talked about the basics of snaring as far as the equipment, kind of how that works and snare supports and different things like that. And I was going to get into actual snaring animals, but we'll go ahead and try to do that today. First, I want to start with coyote because most people that get into snaring, that's the reason it is. And I tell you from my personal experience, learning how to snare a coyote is much easier to be proficient at than learning how to trap a coyote. Because if you find tracks or you find a trail or you find that hair in the fence and you understand the very basics of snaring, there's a good chance when you come back, you're going to have that coyote when he comes through, that is. And if you're going to run a coyote line, I've ran some that has been highly productive. When I go down to Texas and we have the high fences, which a lot of guys are never going to, you know, be able to trap around just because they're not normal all over the place. If you get in a situation like that, snares in the fence will teach you very quickly when you have an obstruction that's that hard. Your coyote catch will go through the roof and you do it so quickly. And one thing that'll kind of humble a foothold trapper at is you can't compete with a high fence when it comes to snares. And you realize there's probably more animals going around you than you're catching. And it's kind of hard to admit, but when you get in a situation that you can truly lock them up in a fence like that, where they either got to go under the fence to leave or come in the property, and you've got a whole ring around 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 acres of ground, you really see how many animals are in an area. But when you start putting foothold traps out, you don't get it. I mean, we've had days in the fence down in Texas taking 20 and 30 coyotes in a 24-hour process. Even though those coyotes are there, it's awful hard to get that many to commit to a foothold trap in the same amount of time. Now, if you're running coyote snares, I will give some advice. If you're getting started in this, the first thing I would look for, because of what I just told you about that fence, is try to find properties that have fences on them. And the kind of fences you're looking for are the old woven wire fence, or something that's similar to that covers a large stretch. You didn't have to completely enclose a property. You just need a long stretch of it so the animals are going back and forth. And I used to use electrical tape to support my snares under a fence because it was rigid, it was quick. And then I went to using wire on some of the more compact fences by weaving the wire through two different strands or two different holes and making it really, really sturdy that way. And I could use those wires. A lot of times these holes would be good year after year. And by using that wire, it allowed me just to go back and set a new snare in the same hole using the same support. So locally, when I used to trap a lot more locally, I have a lot of these fences I could probably still go to today and set up because I used that wire and I left it. And the farmer didn't seem to care, and I told him, and they didn't care at all. Now, as a coyote trapper, the fences that you're, besides the woven wire fences, the stuff that ought to be getting you excited is, one, one that the farmer has let grown up. And it can only be, you know, it can be anywhere from 6 inches to 4 feet. Doesn't really matter. You have that fence in the middle, and it's really just stuffed with brush and grass and different things like that. And that way, as you either walk or drive, you can look and see these tunnels. And then because of the fence, if it's somewhat of a new fence and the barbed wire still has some bite to it, you will see coyote hair on those barbs. So you know that's a dead nut set right there, because you can go in and set it up. And the more of these you get out, you can be a local hero if you go out and really search these places out, where it's going to be much tougher to do with a foothold trap. Now, one thing to keep in mind about these farmers' fences, you know, if it's not a very secure new fence, it's got some tension and it has some tightness to it, don't just wire it off to the fence itself like you see us doing down in Texas. Either stake it to the ground, go off the fence, and if it's a thick, overgrown fence like that, wire it up in that fence a little bit, or go to a fence post. Because I've had this happen to me before, and luckily I knew the farmers well enough, besides a little good ribbon, they didn't really get a hold of me. But a coyote, or you accidentally catch a hog or something like that, or a big sheepdog, he'll take several feet of that fence with him. And then you got to go back and you're spending your time fixing that fence. And it's just if you got a landowner that's iffy about you being there and that happens, you can pretty much kiss that land goodbye. So take care of their fence, because, you know, if they're going to let you trap, that fence is definitely going to take care of you. And I'm going to say one thing about the fences. If you're looking at a fence as a pure killing situation, where you don't want, because you're close to a road or a neighbor or something like that, and you want to kill the coyote real quick, even on high tensile fences, there's enough give in those fences that a lot of times a lock's not going to do what you want. That's when you need to actually go to ground with a stake, use a good disposable or a rebar or a kill pole. That way, when the coyote realizes he's caught and he makes that first lunge, there's no give or take in that fence where it allows it to move back and forth. So if you're trying to kill them, you know, make sure you got a good lock, but make sure that the whatever the end of your snare is hooked to is absolutely rock solid. So when it hits the end of it, it's just like you just, you know, you tied him to your bump of your truck and he's not going to move it. That's what you're shooting for on a type of fence like that. But the ones that are really grown up, especially here in the East, I mean, high potential. And when I was trapping around here, I would spend a lot of time getting permission, and I would do a lot of looking from the road with binoculars. And when I would see the farmers and had these grown-up fence rows, that's the ones I really went after and try to befriend. If they had raccoon problems or beaver problems, even if I was targeting coyotes, I would make sure that I got that property. Because if you set up somewhere in the East and you get 8 or 10 properties with even, you know, a quarter mile of good fence where it's blocking off part of the farm from the other, if you did nothing else except go run those fence snares, there's a good chance in a month you're going to have 100 plus coyotes just off those fence snares. And the beauty of those fence snares is you're probably not going to have to be wasting your time with skunks and possums and house cats and everything else. It's going to be something you're going to want to skin to set that snare off, whether it be a coyote, a cat, a big coon, something like that. And that's a strategy I don't see a lot of people using. But if you're purely going after numbers, like a year we have right now, where if you got just halfway decent coyotes, you're going to be somewhere in that $20 to $30, $35 mark, and you can go out and get these fences, or it's coming up, you know, if you hear the coyote prices are going to go back up or stay that way next year or 5 years from now, however it works out, go out and really put some ground time in finding these fences on these properties and do whatever it takes to get that. Because if you're getting good money for the coyotes, you can run so many fences, whether if it's dry, you can do it out of a truck. If it's not, you can do it off a four-wheeler. You may have to walk some of them. But setting a snare, even at the beginning, probably only going to take you a couple of minutes, where if you're setting footholds every time it rains a lot and snows and freezes and thaws, you got all these other problems. But if you can go out in the east especially and fill these up, and if you're in an area with red fox and you've got this same type of fence, and you really put the time into snaring those red fox, there's a good chance on those particular properties you'll not have a reason to set a foothold trap. Red fox are extremely easy to snare. They're extremely easy to snare in a fence. Like when I was out and I took instruction from Ron and Pete Leggett, I don't know, probably 10 years ago, I guess. I'm not sure. And, I mean, he was showing me all these locations and stuff like that, and Ron knows his fox locations. And that's, if you're ever getting into fox, I'm going to give him a quick plug. And locations is one of the most important things. By midday on the first day, you will be seeing, understanding the terrain and where these traps go so easily by the way he explains it. He's a really good teacher and instructor. But we went to this one farm, and there was a road we drove in on, and there was a little T road, and that's where he puts his traps all the time, and we had a miss right there. And he looks down, and he does his little cup thing to make sure everything's just right, and we're starting to get back in the truck, and I look over, and there's a roving wire fence. I mean, right on the driver's side of the door where he's getting in and out. And there was a wad of fox hair in that thing as big as a baseball. And me being a snareman, besides just being a foothold trapper, I'm like a little a crack baby bouncing around trying to find a snare to put in that hole. He didn't want me to put it in there. And I could think about that all night long, and I was trying to figure out how to get back to that farm to go hang a snare in that fence, because it would have been a caught fox by morning. Didn't work out that way. We did catch the fox the next day in his foothold sets. And since that time, when I get around places here thinking about the fox, when I get around these fences, like on the interstate, where they have, and they'll be, and they block off the back of these culverts and stuff like that, when there's holes there and you see that fox hair, it's almost the most guaranteed thing you're going to do with a fox is hang that snare there. So even if you're not in coyote country and you're a fox trapper, go look these fences up. I'm telling you, you can add, depending on the amount of fences you've got in your animal population, probably 50% fox with only 10% more effort. And if you're just going to be a foothold trapper, I think that's going to hurt you if you just look at it that way, because it's been real easy for me and Ron to hang a snare in that fence, and maybe instead of a double that morning, we could have caught a triple. But I bet if we would have ride around that fence in just a little bit, we probably would have found five or six different places those fox are going through. It wouldn't have took it hardly any more time to check or to set. Let's get back to the coyotes a little bit. One thing about coyotes is the loop size that I think, and this is going to vary from place to place. When I get further out west, the coyotes get smaller. You know, a big coyote out west is 25 pounds. Well, that's a little coyote here in Tennessee, and it's a baby coyote up in Maine. So your loop sizes are going to have to be adjusted to where you're at. But for me, like in Tennessee, Kentucky, Alabama, where an average coyote size is between 32 and 35 pounds, a 14-inch loop that's 14 inches off the ground seems to work the best for me if it's a little open. And what I mean by open is if you've got a trail going through, you know, some high grass or trees, or it's just not really boogered down and really tight, that's what I'm considering open. That 14 and 14 inch loop does better. But that same loop will get you in trouble if you go to use that loop size when you start getting into really thick brush. Because if you ever watch a dog when he's going through that type of brush, he doesn't have hands to stick up there and block that out of the brush and briars and stuff out of his face. So what he does is he'll lower his head and he'll push through that stuff with the top of his forehead. He don't want it, you know, pricking his nose and hitting him in the eyes. He uses the top of his head. That's why a lot of your dogs, if they ever get, you know, rabbit hunting and stuff, they'll have really bloody ears because they put their head down and they bulldog through there a little bit. Coyotes do the same thing. So if you've got a 14 inch loop, it's 14 inches off the ground, and you're in thick cover like that, And you know, I mean, it's tight. There's a trail there, but you know this stuff's going to be brushing the coyote in the head. You can drop that loop size down to about 10 inches and drop that thing down to about 9 to 10 inches off the ground, and your catch will go up. If you leave the 14-inch loop 14 inches off the ground, and you got really tight stuff like we have in the east with all the briars and the everything that you'll see when you get in really good habitat, that taller loop, a lot of times the coyote will hit that, I believe, with his forehead and just go slap under the snare because his head's down. It's almost like he's going down a go-down or something, the way his body size is. Just have a dog, if you've got one, go and take him somewhere thick and watch what he does, and you'll see what I'm talking about. You might could catch him in an open trail with a higher snare, but in the thicker type trail, you better drop that loop down a little bit. And that's helpful in some of the states that have got these, you know, loop size restrictions. One of the biggest things that I've noticed with the coyote type snaring is the more that I can hide the support in the wire and the lock and break up that loop, either with just the way the natural grass and the natural brambles are going, the higher my catch is. You can catch coyotes, a certain number of coyotes, that are obviously thinking about their girlfriend or what's going to be at the movies this weekend or something. I've actually caught coyotes on cattle trails with grass 2 inches thick and just have the loop sitting there, 14 inches off the ground, 14-inch loop. It doesn't happen that often, but sometimes it will work. But I guarantee you that's probably a small percentage of the coyotes. And when you see a lot of snaring, especially when you look back in some of the older books and they're going through the woods and things, they'll tie off to a tree with their support wire, and then there'll be a loop right there, and you'll have all that wire and all that cable and lock and everything, and it'll just be sitting way out there in the open in a real open type situation because there's a trail going through there, but the tree was convenient. So that's what they wired the snare support off and the snare off to. If you leave all that stuff hanging out there in midair, in my opinion, you're going to have a lot of coyotes that are going to refuse that. If you were to bring in a little bit of grass or bend some grass over where it's hiding the support and the lock and the snare support and everything like that, and it breaks that up so it's not looking like a man-made circle sitting there, I think you're better off. Another thing you can do with coyote snares that'll really help you with refusals is try to pick those places, instead of having a straight shoot of a trail, try to get close to a bend of it. Because what happens when we're walking down a trail, when something's straight out in front of you, anything that's in that trail is going to stand out like a sore thumb. But if you get to where a bend is at, you start getting confused on what is right in front of you or the limbs and everything that's behind it, because now the trail's bending off to the side and you've got all that other clutter and angles and everything like that that really help break up your lock. So if you've got these angles in your trail, you're better off setting it to that. Another tip for you on your coyote snaring that really help out a lot, if you've got an open field and your coyotes are coming out to that field or going in that trail and you're setting these up, don't hang that snare right on the edge of it. That's one of the worst things you can do. Because if a coyote is going from the open field to the snare, the first thing he's going to come in contact with is that loop sitting there. And it's going to be really obvious sitting right on the edge. And if he's coming from the woods going to the open field, it's going to be just silhouetted out in that open field, and it's going to be very obvious to him. If you just move it in 3 or 4 feet, now you get the stuff on the side and it's irregular, and it helps hide that snare loop on you a whole lot, and it'll really help you out in that. I know a lot of guys that will just run snares that are bold. Some of the best coyote snaring I've done, like we said last week, is when I really painted the snares and broke the outline of it up. I learned that from O'Gorman, and I think his snaring 4 video or 3 And he broke it up with a paint, and I thought that was kind of neat, and I went out and tried it, and it did. It made a huge difference. It also made a big difference on the cats. Our terrain here is a lot different than it is out in, say, Montana, in places like that, because we have so much ground stuff to help block that in. So when you paint it up in those splotches, it really helps. And if you didn't hear the show last week, doing it in the full metal jacket, I've got a whole story why it's important. And it's not a sales pitch because I don't make any money off of it. I've sold that part to F&T. But it knocks that odor down. And at the same time, if you got those painted snares that are in splotches, knocks the visual down, and it'll really help on your refusals. Now, one thing, I think it was Scott Adams that was doing this a couple of years ago, I thought was pretty clever, is he lives in a part of Ohio that the snow's going to come, and it's going to eventually leave, and it's going to come back, and it does this all winter long. Now, if you have a painted snare that's going to blend into grass or a woodland setting, when the snow hits, it stands out. So it'd be nice if you had a white snare, or mostly white snare. But if you take a painted snare, as soon as the snow melts, now you got a white snare in a woodland setting, and it doesn't match very well. What Scott was doing is he was taking chalk, and he was actually breaking that up. It was almost like a powder, and he was rubbing that around that cable. It didn't slow the cable down. It didn't add any bulk or anything like that. And it wouldn't be a solid white from what he was saying, because, you know, it's not going to be like it's painted on there. But what it does, it really hides that snare in the snow. And if the snow leaves, you can take your glove and get most of that off of there, and you're still going to have it splotchy. And keep in mind, animals see in black and white. They don't see the same color spectrum we do, but it's still going to be blotchy. And then if it snows again, you just put more chalk on it. And it's something you can do without having to change these snares out, because, you know, around here, when I camouflage paint my snares, and we do get the snow, which isn't very often, I can see my snares 50, 60 feet away. I mean, very, very easy. And when that happens here, my catch goes down. As soon as the snow starts melting and they start blending in back better, then my catch goes back up. So if you're in a situation like Scott where you got to deal with off and on snow, I would actually go and try the chalk thing. If you live in a place where you're going to have all the time snow in the winter, I would definitely be painting those things white. You know, the whitest whites you can get a hold of. So it'll blend in really good. And the few times I've tried that around here just to see what it would do, they're really hard to see until you get right up on them. And if you're going to paint them white like that, and I don't recommend going up to your snares all the time, but if you start getting snow buildup on them, every now and then go by and just slap them a little bit so there's not snow hanging there in midair when you really can't see what it's hanging on. So if you get rid of that snow, that seemed to help me out a little bit on that. I want to talk a little bit about setting up your coyote snare line. Of course, the more access you've got to a single piece of property, the better it's going to be. But snaring is not something that's going to be very fast, in my opinion, unless you scout it out ahead of time. Because there's a lot of things you're going to have to take a look-see at to see if it's a good trail, if there's sign going to it, where it's going to, different things like that. And you really don't want to be doing that while you're trapping. So if you're going to plan out ahead and actually run a snare line for coyotes, you need to put some thought into it. And you need to go out and pre-scout it. Some of the funnest trap lines that I've ran here in the mountains of Tennessee were with snares. And I didn't start off with snares. I started off with traps. And as the weather just kept deteriorating, kind of like the weather we have right now, where it freezes, then it thaws, and then it rains 3 inches, then it freezes, then it rains again, then it sleets, and then we get an ice storm. And it was just constant work. So I started going to snares and got rid of the traps, and I was running on two different sections of really big strip mines that were up on the mountain, and altogether it was probably 7,000-8,000 acres probably. And when I first started setting them, I started setting the easiest noticeable trails that just kind of jumped out at you, and I set all those I could. And then when I was running the line the next time, I slowed down and I started setting up the smaller trails that, you know, didn't really get your attention as much, but there's probably some stuff going down it. And that's when I also started setting all of the four-wheeler roads and the trapping, not trapping roads, but the gravel roads that had grass going all the way up except for the tire tracks. And I started setting those roads up. Well, lo and behold, in about a week and a half, I had 300-400 snares out. Now, it didn't matter to me at that point if it rained, it snowed, it sleeted. The only thing that could hurt it really at that time was freezing rain, and it would melt off and they'd still be in place. When I had that many snares out on that many trails, that's when something really clicked in my head about coyote snaring. What we think is the best coyote location for snares is no better than a lot of the side trails that we bypass. And that's an important thing to keep in mind, because if you're just going to, you know, the supreme looking trails, you're going to miss as many or more coyotes by passing the smaller trails a lot of times. And I mean, I was setting everything. And that's when this really came to me in such a clear way, is because trails that I probably would never set if I was in a hurry or mixing in foothold traps, I was putting them there because I was driving past them anyway. And my brain started really clicking and nothing but snaring, and I started seeing more trails because my subconscious was really looking for them. And then I started noticing tracks going down places on the side of the road where the road grader and the erosion would go off, and I started noticing so many different places to put snares, but I had all those snares out. And off that amount of acreage, there was days I was catching 6-7 coyotes and a couple of cats and some gray fox and coon. I mean, I was having a good old time, but I wasn't having to get down and play in that mud. But it's not something you're going to be able to do on a situation like that on a weekend, because it takes a lot of time to put those many snares in. It takes a lot of time to pull those many snares. But in between the setting and the pulling, it's nothing but drag racing and fun at that point, because it's as quick as you get to the next one to see what you got. And you'll be amazed at how many animals are out there when you start locking up all the travel ways like that. Now, if you're in an area that's got a lot of deer, one thing I've noticed over time, if you use the kill poles, you have less problems with deer. Because you can take a kill pole and put it in, and from the angle of a coyote, he doesn't seem to be able to notice things as much. But a deer, because they're standing higher, they seem to see that pole and the whole rig up a whole lot better, and they avoid that so much better than they do if you're running a snare support or something off a bush or off a stick or something. That kill pole, because it's going to be 3 foot off the ground probably, the top of it, you can leave that little bit exposed on top. It's not going to be noticeable by the coyote as he's coming down that trail, but to a deer, he's definitely going to see it, and most of them will bypass that back. Now, deer, I know a lot of people are going, well, I'm scared to set a trail because of a deer. Most of the time, when you're going to have deer problems, it's within normally 2 days or a day of you setting that. And a lot of the trouble guys are going to have with deer is they walk in every day to actually physically get within a couple of feet of that snare to look at it, to check it out, you know, see, make sure it's not knocked down. But when you're doing that, you're bringing that human scent in over and over and over again. And eventually the deer, especially the does, get really curious about that, and they'll start following you in there. Even though technically on some of the coyote snares are only 10 inches and 10 inches off the ground, you should just be hitting them in the chest and they knock it over. But they're going in with their nose closer to the ground because they're smelling you. So if you're worried about the deer, don't go back right up to those snares. Use some binoculars and look at them from a distance. I also think going to check those snares that close all the time can turn some coyotes off, because every time you're going past there every day, you're leaving scent. I don't care what you're doing or what you're wearing. You're rubbing up against brush. You got skin cells that are falling off. You know, I'm not a big scent freak by any stretch. But over and over and over, it's going to build up and build up and build up. And I think a lot of coyotes, especially the older coyotes, are going to start refusing that trail altogether. They're not going to know that there's a snare on it, but they're going to think there's something there that may be danger to them, and they're not going to go up to it. Last thing I want to talk about coyote snaring is it needs to look natural. One of the things I've noticed from giving so much of instruction, when I have guys set snares, you can see that and know something is going on there from several yards away really quick. You know, a coyote is not something that's going to allow you to put in sticks like you can for a beaver. It's going to refuse that pretty quick. Because not that he knows that there's a snare there or you set a trap to catch him there, but as he's going down that trail, it's going to be something that's unusual. And a lot of times he'll start circling it. And when that happens, he's going to get off that trail, which brings up a good point. A lot of guys will try to use bait and scent real close to a snare, thinking, you know, that I've talked to some guys that think that if you put a coyote snare in a trail and like 10 inches away, like a foothold, you put a big glob of lure, that you'll catch him almost like he'll reach his neck through the loop and do that. And that's just not what's going to happen. If you've got a lot of human scent there, or you got something that looks unnatural there, or you put a scent really close to that snare, when he gets that, because a coyote uses his nose more than anything else, I believe, to go through the world, he's going to go downwind. Unless downwind is perfectly aligned with that snare, he's going to be off that snare to figure out what's going on. And then he's going to continue on his way, and it's taking your snare completely out of the equation. Well, I guess I've got one more thing that I want to talk about on this pretty good. And if y'all got some ideas and things on snaring and things you've learned over time, you know, please post that in the comments under the radio show, because I know I'd like to hear about it myself, and I'm sure other people would too. I want to talk about bait stations. Like when me and Matt did our Coyote Chaos video, we really hammered the coyotes on the bait stations. What you didn't see on the video, though, is the first 4 or 5 days of that, those were dead as a hammer. And the reason was it was warm. When the temperature dropped, that's when the coyotes started working the bait a lot more, and that's when all those catches that you saw on the video started happening. And if you're, and I know a lot of guys in the deep south will start hanging this or start putting out these bait stations way too early before it gets cold, and it's a lackluster result, and that's the reason. But bait stations can be tremendous for catching coyotes, because you may have one that's dormant for a week or so, and if you go out and you put out a lot of bait stations and really put the time into it, the beauty of the bait stations is all of a sudden now, instead of catching one coyote in a trail, there's a chance around a good bait station, if you play it right, that you're catching 3, 4, 5, or 6 coyotes off of one location. And then maybe you get a straggler here and there. But most of the time, if you set it up heavy enough and in the right type situation, you can almost take the whole family group out at one time if they're running together in a bait station like that. And a really neat trick to a bait station, it's probably one of the most deadliest things I've ever seen, and I do it a lot of times if I'm doing a lot of beaver trapping and I've got a good trail that I think coyotes are working, and I'm in a hurry and I'm not really coyote trapping anyway, but I will chop a beaver in half, and then I'll have a chunk of beaver or a whole beaver, and then I'll go down the trail about 30 feet, 20 feet, but I want them in line sight of each other. And in the middle of that, I'm going to put 2 or 3 snares in the middle of the trail, so the bait's actually on the outside. But I tell you what I think happens and reason this is so effective. I think the coyotes, when they're eating the beaver that they're eating, they're just like every other creature, especially us. They're looking and they see the other chunk of beaver over there. They're eating this one, nothing's bad happened, and they're going to go check it out. And when they go from the bait to the bait, they've got that other bait on their mind and they're not paying attention to their surroundings as much. I think the coyotes are a lot more spooky and they're a lot more cautious getting to the first taste of the bait. And once that happens, there's nothing there that's bad happening to them in the situation I'm talking about, and they can go through there. So if you're setting up your bait stations, instead of having one big pile all the time, you know, you can have 2 or 3 piles, but always put them in line sight of each other and then set the snares up in between them. So instead of just guarding the outside of your bait station, try to put some thought into it where you can have the snares inside the bait station, and when they see one piece of bait to the other, or you got one coyote that's actually, you know, like an older coyote that's going to run off a smaller coyote, and he sees the other meat, he's heading straight for it. And if it's really thick and you've got the trail set up, now you got a chance to catch him too. There's a lot of chaos, I think, that goes along with these bait stations. I think once you catch one and you've got more than two or three snares sitting there, the other coyotes are going to circle and come in and circle, and that's when you start really picking them up. So if you're going to go with the bait station concept, don't be afraid to put 15 or 20 snares out around a really good bait station if it's good and cold and you've got the cover to do it. It'll be worth it in the long run. It used to seem like it got a lot colder here, and I'd run a lot of bait stations, and I could keep up a really good coyote average off those without a whole lot of maintenance once I got the first amount of meat out there, because instead of just catching one coyote at a bait station or that trail, like I said, I could catch multiple ones. And that's the advantage of the bait station. It's the chaos, and I'm all running around. Now, if you're throwing a bait station out and you just got one trail set up going in and out, it's not really taking full advantage of the idea of the bait station. You need to find a little bit better location where you can have multiple trails going into it, where you've got multiple trails going sideways and where they can circle it, and you need to set all those up. Another way of a bait station that it's not really as common as it used to be, but instead of having one big pile or having two or three smaller piles, if you pick a location on your bait station areas, and if you really have a whole bunch of smaller size baits, like you've got scraps from a butcher, spread them out over an area that's 30 or 40 feet wide. Have them everywhere. Just throw them. They don't have to be on the trail. You just want them everywhere. Spread out. Some thrown here, some thrown over there. But you've already set all these trails up in between. You can bet your bottom dollar when coyotes get into that, you're going to have the family group response going on, where the alpha dogs are going to be the one that's going to start eating right off, and they're going to chase off the younger ones. The younger ones are going to be wanting to get some food, and because they smell so darn well, they're going to know there's other bait out there. And then they're going to start running around picking these little pieces of bait up, and they're going to start finding your snares. Once they start finding those snares, the chaos principle kicks in, and the adults are going to go charging in to try to figure out what's going on with the young ones. At the same time, there's a good chance they're going to start finding your snares. The other little ones are going to start running around like kids trying to figure out what's going on. And all this chaos is going on when you have the bait station set up instead of having one pile spread everywhere. So that's three different ways to set these bait stations up. If you're in an area where that you're going to be locally, and you come across, you know, some roadkill cats and some butcher scraps and a deer or whatever, someone's goats dies, and you know you're going to be setting it up, even if it's July, go throw that out there in the same area. And if you continually do that over 12 months, you'll have a place those coyotes are going to always come check out. So it's kind of like pre-baiting, but over a long period of time. I noticed when I was taking instruction from Johnny, every time we'd come across a smushed cat or something on the road, and he would put it in his truck, then we'd get close to one of his fisher holes or mink holes or fox holes, he would always have a tree stump or a rock pile or something sitting right there, and he'd put that in there, and he does that all the time. Those animals get used to coming in because they know there's something, you know, the nature gods give them a gift every now and then, and every time they get close, they're going to go by and check it out, and you can use that to your advantage later. Well, I guess that's going to put us about out of time. I hope some of this information, if you're new to coyote snaring or not, I hopefully pick something up out of this that'll help you. Snaring's one of those things that's even hard to do on to write about it or having a video, and it's definitely hard just to talk about it. But hopefully there was something here that you could pick up that'll catch you a few more coyotes this year or next year or down the road. But think outside of the box on your bait stations. Always keep everything really natural looking on your coyote snares. Make sure they're good and rigid. Keep the idea of an open trail loop bigger and a tighter trail, smaller and a little bit lower to the ground. Really hunt out those fences and you'll have a good coyote season. You know what's better than talking about coyote snaring? That's actually coyote snaring. So let's go snaring.